This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with industry experts and SG2 thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we all expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery.
Our business model, which many of you know is just simply defined as the way we produce and sell a product in a market, does not support an optimal care delivery or clinical care delivery model, the way clinical services are actually delivered, the way clinicians want to practice. More care is not necessarily better care, and it doesn't make sense, and it's not efficient.
Hello, and welcome to SG2 Perspectives. I am your host, Kelly Richard, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with James Harker, Chief Population Health Officer at Providence St. Joseph Health System in Oregon. We'll be discussing value-based care strategy. We covered so much ground in our conversation that the following is part one of a two-part series. Part two will be released next week. It's been a rough year, but there's always value-based care. And I think that this is our light in the tunnel here from a payment perspective. Your title is Chief Population Health Officer at a major health system, and not all health systems have that role in their C-suite. Can you tell me a little bit about the journey to your leadership position?
Kelly, let me say thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss what I think is a really important topic. Value-based care is a broad term and has a lot of connotations for people. So I appreciate the opportunity to dig in a little bit further and talk about why I think it's a critical transformation for healthcare. I have been with Providence for a long time, just over 20 years. Most of that time, I've been in strategic and business planning roles. And during that time, our ministry as Providence has evolved from a mid-sized, regionally focused provider to one of the largest integrated systems in the country. Providence here in Oregon has always been a leader in integrated health solutions because of the continuum of care that we have in the family, from the healthcare financing function represented by our own health plan, through primary health services, ambulatory, ancillary care services. We have 8 acute facilities here in the state, as well as continuing care services. We're proud of that continuum, and it's allowed us to do some unique and innovative things. So given that broad base of resources and strong leadership, and with any modicum of strategic planning chops in my original role, it was pretty clear to us that we had a strategic opportunity to continue to grow and to differentiate ourselves by building on this value-based population healthcare model.
We look at other health systems and we look just nationally at the rate of progression toward value-based care versus fee-for-service. Why do you think Providence specifically has prioritized population health when we're comparing it to other organizations? Is it organizational vision or simply the market demand?
Sure. I guess I would distinguish a little bit, Kelly, between the why we've prioritized it and why we've been able to move more rapidly. And the latter is because of the reason I just gave. I don't take any credit for building the strength of the continuum of services that we have here in Oregon. It's been in place for many years. And it's on that foundation that we've been able to innovate. Because we have many of those resources in the family, particularly the direct partnership with an owned health plan, we've been able to do some innovative things. But the prioritization kind of goes back to that strategic question. What is it about the market that lends itself to our leaning so heavily in this direction of value-based care or population health? And I would point to three things. I think there's a fundamental lack of alignment between our clinical care delivery model and a fee-for-service healthcare business model. I'd say a second reason is just this continued cost growth in our industry is we hear all the time people talk about it's not sustainable. And that, I'm afraid, the phrase has become a bit cliche. It's too easy to say that without sort of recognizing the impact that that has on people, on employers. We're a small employer state with a lot of employees of small employers. Affordability is a big deal for us. And then lastly, I would say just growing customer demand for accountability. So first, this lack of alignment between our models. I admit up front and I state clearly up front, I'm not a clinician and I don't play one on TV even, but I talk to a lot of them and I work alongside a lot of them. And it was clear to me many years ago as I got deeper into this work that our business model, which many of you know is just simply defined as the way we produce and sell a product in a market, does not support an optimal care delivery or clinical care delivery model, the way clinical services are actually delivered, the way clinicians want to practice. We, all of us, those of you listening to this podcast and me certainly, we have built a healthcare business model in this country that rewards and values volume and revenue. You do more, you make more money. We've built a business model that mirrors most every other consumer product industry in our country. If you sell more products, you generate more revenue. That's an axiom that every business student in this country is taught. The problem in healthcare is the product that we produce and sell, more appropriately, I believe, reflects a social service than it does a consumer good. More care is not necessarily better care. And you got to hang around with clinicians a while to have that beat into you. Besides a myriad of access and equity issues, selling more product is not always the best clinical solution, or providing or doing more clinical product testing or services is not always the best solution. And it certainly does not align with the way that physicians and clinicians want to practice medicine. So there's a disconnect, and I felt that, and it doesn't make sense, and it's not efficient. And that was one of our drivers. This idea of continued cost growth, we believe, is connected to the incentives or the drivers of that cost curve. Physicians that I spoke about feel tremendous accountability for the quality of the work they do. They're comfortable and they're willing to take accountability for the affordability of the work that they do. It's much more effective when I speak to clinicians to have conversations about affordability, not about budgets or total cost of care. They believe deeply in affordability for the patients they serve. We need to understand that. To do that, to own and share that accountability, these clinicians, they need to understand the true cost of the work that they do. They want to be engaged in discussions about how to manage that cost. And we believe that transparency is the first step to doing that. In any industry, that part of the organization that produces the product needs to understand the cost of that product. And today in healthcare, that's not the case. That link to affordability, I think, is broken. And then lastly, customer accountability. I think both government and private customers are our services of the product that we produce. Again, of healthcare services are tired of this cost curve, and they want greater accountability directly from health systems. I mean, large employers understand who they're purchasing healthcare from. The financing function represented by health plans can only do so much, and not enough, frankly, to control that actual affordability of care and owning that accountability. The entity that pays for our product is our customer. More and more, by the way, another interesting topic for another time is just how much our industry is becoming a direct purchase product or a service by individual consumers. But I think those three reasons have driven us.
Something that really stood out to me that you said was the idea of healthcare being really more of a social good than it is a consumer product. And we have all of these other competitors coming into the mix, these national retailers that are starting to provide care. And I'm wondering if there's a way to differentiate as a health system when you're presenting yourself to the market, is showing that you think of it as more than just this consumer good, this race to the bottom. Is that a strategy for differentiating a health system from some of these other competitors that are nibbling around the edges of the services that are being provided?
Just to be clear, Kelly, I don't have any problem with more efficient delivery of healthcare services. I mean, some of the things that we describe as retail health are an attempt to do that, I believe. But again, I think healthcare is a different product. We have a big relationship with Intel here in Oregon as Providence. And when an employer like Intel approaches us, they're not looking for an episodic treatment of care at a local pharmacy. They're looking to buy health and wellness for their population so that they can effectively deliver the product that they produce. And the employers that I've worked with, they do care about the wellness and sort of the longitudinal health experience of their employees and their families. It's not just a product they're purchasing. It's not just a food product. They believe in health service. I don't have a problem with that. I think where we differentiate ourselves is being able to communicate the fact that we can take accountability for and deliver longitudinal health and wellness, a relationship that is going to be of value to those employees, not an episode of care.
We have covered the impact of COVID-19 on value-based care quite a bit on this podcast, and we often get somewhat of a measured answer here. Can you give me your take on what you think COVID-19's impact is on the direction of value-based care?
Sure. I'll go in sort of two related but different directions on that. Two things I feel strongly about. COVID has certainly taught us of the value of prepayment or value-based care models. Across Providence St. Joseph Health and our different regions, we have very different levels of prepayment or capitation or alternative payment models where we both have accountability for but share in a portion of the premium for a population versus regions of our health system that are much more fee-for-service. Most anyone in this organization would tell you that COVID has shown that value-based care is economically more stable given an experience like COVID, where utilization dropped considerably. There was also tremendous fear. Our traditional revenue generators, surgical services and procedures and imaging, dropped off dramatically. And in a business model where you're very dependent on volume and revenue and high margin services, you're going to feel that really fast. In a region like Oregon, where we partner closely with our health plan, and we share accountability for the total premium, it's much more sustainable for experiences like COVID, kind of periods of time, what COVID has caused. But I'd say just a related issue that COVID has really shown for us is just the tremendous disparity of health outcomes across at-risk communities, particularly communities of color. We have a real commitment to equity and justice at Providence St. Joseph. It's part of our mission for 165 plus years. We believe healthcare is a human right. And that human right is not felt equally across populations. And I think COVID has shined an even brighter light on that we need to respond to as healthcare.
Agreed. When you're thinking about some of these models being more successful than others, and you mentioned capitation and sort of prepayment or prospective payment, we see a lot of organizations, and you had even mentioned there's parts of Oregon that are much more fee-for-service oriented. Do you think that something like a primary care cap carve-out versus going all the way to capitation is potentially a way to get there for systems that maybe don't have a health plan or that aren't quite in the type of a market that's as receptive to something as extreme as capitation?
Super good question, because it is a journey. And I think we do need a broad range of these alternative payment models, both to match market dynamics, but perhaps more importantly, to match the preparedness of different groups to participate in those models. Capitation is a different beast. It requires different accounting, different analytics, different kind of reporting, different kind of transparency for providers. And it takes time to learn that, to gain that expertise. PCP cap is a terrific way to start towards an accountable prepayment model. I really am fond of the HCP LAN framework, and I couldn't tell you what that acronym stands for off the top of my head. But the HCP LAN framework does a better job than any I've seen of laying out the different types of these alternative payment models. And it progresses in the level of quote unquote risk. I like the term accountability better, the level of accountability that a health provider bears. And as you move toward the farthest end of that continuum, you are bearing total cost of care accountability or risk. The beauty or the benefit of PCP cap is two things in my mind. It's more easily defined. You can get your arms around it in a series of CPT codes that are manageable, that are understood, that primary care providers understand. And therefore, you can define a portion of the healthcare premium dollar. And you can designate that for quote unquote primary health or primary care services. And you can assign that to groups based on the number of these members or lives that they have. And that becomes their budget. It's manageable, it's transparent, it's understandable for primary care physicians. The same thing is more difficult to do in specialty services. And many folks listening to this will understand this way better than I do. But it's much more difficult to get your arm around a defined set of services in some specialties. The other thing I think about PCP cap is that it directly affects incentives and practice patterns. I have been absolutely impressed with how quickly behaviors change in our primary care groups here in Portland in particular, when you allow those primary care physicians the sort of professional courtesy, frankly, of transparency and understanding of and accountability for the budget for the work that they do. And their practice patterns change. When you take them off of that treadmill of RVU, requirements of seeing so many patients a day just to generate RVUs, to generate an income, and frankly, a budget for their clinics, when you can relieve them from that treadmill, their practice patterns change for the benefit of the patient, the customer, the person we're trying to serve. We had practices in our medical group that were seeing more than 50% of their patients via virtual means before COVID hit, because they owned that budget and because it was appropriate care. It was more convenient for the patient. I sat and I shadowed one of our physicians doing these visits. And this was a woman who was having a visit with her PCP during a break at work. It was an easy follow-up. It was better for everyone. There was no need for an office visit. So it lines up incentives. It makes the clinical care delivery model, optimal clinical care, match the business model. It's ideal.
I would think that if you carved out primary care, you would certainly reduce the total cost of primary care, but do we have the data to show whether that reduces the total cost of care for that patient throughout the system?
I don't know that we do have that complete data set, again, because we have the most experience with primary care capitation so far. And I think it's going to take different alternative payment models to create the same kind of accountability in some specialties. I'm always sensitive about referring to reducing the cost of care, reducing that budget. I think the first step is just transparency and awareness and accountability, and then driving affordability. Too often, at least in some of the independent groups and our own providers that we've spoken to, if you're too quick to talk about reducing the cost of care, that's translated into improving the bottom line or driving more margin somehow. I get the hairs on the back of my neck bristle a little bit when we talk about what we're doing this in service to. And it's got to be about lowering that premium, that rate of growth of the cost curve, and therefore the rate of growth of the premium in the market.
And of course, the quality and the outcomes, because as a country, we don't have very good outcomes, in large part likely because we aren't doing enough quality preventive care on the primary care side.
Which suddenly makes financial sense, right?
Right.
Suddenly, when you have that primary care budget, that capitated budget, you invest in things like that. Yep.
Right. And you had mentioned the HCP LAN. I think it's the Healthcare Plan Learning and Action Network, but I'm going to definitely have to look that up later. But we use that organization as well. And I think that their measurement of progression toward value-based care is just about the best that we have in terms of just measurement of across the industry.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. In part two of this series, we will continue this discussion on value-based care with James Harker from Providence St. Joe's, Oregon. If you like what you're hearing, please also listen and subscribe to our colleague, Dr. Tom Villanueva's Modern Practice podcast on Vizient's Medical Leadership channel. Tom discusses key healthcare trends through the clinical leadership lens. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening and stay healthy.
This has been another great episode of SG2 Perspectives, where industry experts and SG2 thought leaders explore the drivers of tomorrow's healthcare strategies to inform today's decision makers. Contact us anytime by sending an email to sg2perspectives@sg2.com. We'd love to hear from you. SG2 revolutionized healthcare demand forecasting with the Impact of Change forecast, and today we're the industry's premier strategy advisory firm. To learn more, visit sg2.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.